May it please the court. My name is James Frazier, and I'm pleased to represent Mr. Thomas Royal in this case. The government concedes that Mr. Royal was not guilty unless the bullets at issue were designed for use in a non-antique firearm. However, the government offered no expert testimony about the design of the bullets at all. As a result, Mr. Royal is entitled to a judgment of acquittal. I think this case boils down to the fact that there was a deficiency in the government's expert testimony. In a typical Gun Control Act case, the government presents expert testimony to establish that the weapon in question meets the statutory definition of a prohibited item. This case was a bit unusual in that the government's expert witness spent a significant part of his time establishing that the gun involved in this case did not meet the definition of firearm under the federal statute.
We normally don't require an expert testifying on behalf of the government to establish that a firearm meets the legal definition of a firearm. So my question is, why would we change that rule in effect and require the government's expert to testify that ammunition meets the legal definition of ammunition?
Well, Your Honor, I think there can be cases where, and I don't think the expert witness has to testify that, yes, this gun meets the definition of firearm under federal law. Mm-hmm. But what the expert witness does is establish those facts that bring the gun under the definition of firearm under federal law, so that the expert witness would testify that this is an instrumentality that is designed to expel a projectile through an explosion. And in fact, we've cited three circuit court cases in our brief where that was at issue, where on appeal, the defendant said, hey, the government didn't establish that this was a firearm. And the court noted, yes, the ATF agent came in, testified that this gun was designed to expel a projectile through an explosion. In this case, the government spent a significant amount of time with its expert explaining to the jury why this particular gun did not meet the definition of firearm under federal law. And it spent so much time, and I think it was so concerned with explaining to the jury why the defendant wasn't being charged with having this revolver, that it lost sight of the fact that one of the things it had to prove was that the bullets were designed to be used in a firearm, in a non-antique firearm. And the government has conceded that in its brief. It has not contested our argument that the definition of ammunition under the statute, where the statute said bullets are ammunition if designed for use in a firearm. Firearm in that phrase means non-antique firearm. And the government hasn't challenged us on that, and in fact says, well, it's an affirmative defense. And our argument is that, well, by saying it's an affirmative defense, they're conceding that we've got the correct definition of the statute. But the government had its expert witness testify about the firearm, and then it didn't meet the definition of firearm. And then when it came time to turn to the expert testimony about the bullets, it just sort of skipped over having the expert testify that, well, these bullets are designed to be used in a non-antique firearm. Didn't testify that the bullets were designed to be used in any firearm, even a modern firearm. Instead, what the expert witness did is proceed right into testifying about the inner commerce, whether the bullets had traveled in interstate commerce.
Well, I suppose that the chief judge's question was, but whose burden was it to, if the government conceded that the question of whether or not the firearm was an antique is an affirmative defense, then it logically follows that the defense had some burden to show that the rounds were also for use in an antique firearm, not the other way around.
Now, our position is that in this situation, the design of the bullets was not an affirmative defense. This is not a situation where there was just no testimony, no evidence about raising an issue about the antique aspect of one of the items at issue. I believe that in any case where a defendant is charged with possession of ammunition. It's up to the government to establish that the items that were found, these pieces of metal, are in fact designed to be used in a firearm. I think maybe the best way to think about this is take the antique gun out of the situation completely. This gun was recovered during a traffic stop. And allegedly the gun was in my client's jacket pocket. Well, what if they had found no gun at all, but just bullets? It's our position that the government would need to put on its expert witness to testify about two things. One would be the Interstate Commerce Clause aspect of the case, but the other would be some sort of testimony that, yes, these are in fact bullets that are designed to be used in a firearm. And there was no testimony about that at all. Now, maybe hypothetically you could think of a situation where that wouldn't be required, but in this case, where you've got the extra fact that the bullets were actually found in something that is not a firearm, our position is that takes us into an area where, you know, you've got to have expert testimony about the design of the bullets, because if you don't, then there's no evidence from which a lay jury that presumably doesn't know anything about guns or ammunition can determine beyond a reasonable doubt that, yes, these pieces of metal are in fact designed to be used in a non-antique firearm.
Well, are you saying that where a statute contains exceptions to a general rule that the government has to, as part of its burden of proof, has to negate all of the exceptions, produce evidence to negate all of the exceptions?
I'm not, Your Honor.
How then would you characterize the statement, such term does not include an antique firearm, if that's not an exception? I may be wrong. It just looks to me like an exception to the general rule, and I don't know how to characterize it any other way, but maybe you do and can help me.
You're correct that it is an exception, the antique firearms exception. Our position is that in any ammunition case, there's got to be some sort of testimony establishing just the basic element of the case, which is that this thing is in fact designed to be used in a firearm. In this case, that didn't happen. And it might be, Your Honor, that if there were no antique firearm recovered in this case, and we were here today based on the same testimony, excluding the antique firearm. It was just bullets found in the pocket.
Let me try to narrow it even more.
Sure.
I'm not saying the government doesn't have to prove it doesn't fall within the exception, but they got to be on, as a general matter, they don't have to prove it until there's some challenge or they're put on some notice that it's a defense, and I just didn't see that in this case.
I don't think that they, well, first of all, I think the evidence in this case, the government's own evidence, raises that possibility. I mean, you've got an expert witness who spends the first half of his testimony talking about explaining to the jury why this isn't a firearm under federal law, and it's specifically asked the question, quote, does that particular firearm meet the definition of firearm as defined by federal law? So we've got evidence that does raise that particular issue, and the government should have been on notice of that based on the testimony of its own expert, and not just because it was an antique firearm, but in addition to that, the expert witness testified, gave a lot of testimony about the antique firearm, that the gun was an Ivor Johnson revolver built in 1898, I believe, that there are experts on this firearm, that there's been a gun, there was a book written in the early 90s about these guns. So we've got a situation where not just any old antique firearm, but apparently one that's got some interest, some popularity. With that factual basis, the government's got to be on notice at that point that, you know, bullets need to be designed to work in a modern firearm in order to fall under the statute. We need to establish that fact. And the government didn't do that.
You keep referring to the rounds or evidence in this case as pieces of metal, but the government's brief summarizes the testimony of the expert as follows, that he examined the ammunition, determined that all five rounds of ammunition were 32 caliber in design and manufactured in either Connecticut, Arkansas, or Illinois. I mean, the term ammunition was used throughout this trial, wasn't it? And this the fact that the expert testified that this was 32 caliber ammunition, absent any challenge from the defense that somehow this ammunition was couldn't be used in the manner that ammunition is intended to be used, what was there for the government to prove beyond that? Or for a jury to be satisfied that the government had met its burden of proof?
Sure. I think the government needed to ask its expert witness, is the ammunition designed to be used in a firearm, a non-antique firearm? I understand the question about the caliber of the bullets. Caliber simply means size. I would submit that when you start getting into, and some people know a lot about guns, Your Honor, and a lot of people don't. I was, in the Air Force for 6 years. I never fired a gun, and I had to look up what 32 caliber meant when I started working on this case. And there are other people who might know things about guns, but. So I don't think we can just assume that this is something that a lay jury can figure out on its own. This needs to be something that an expert very simply could probably explain if need be.
Well, let me ask you this. Absent this issue of the antique weapon, the firearm in this case, would the government be bound in every case to make that present that evidence to the jury?
About the design of the Of the rounds? Your Honor, I don't think the court needs to make a rule that is that broad, because there might be some hypothetical situation, with the evidence presented would be enough for a lay jury to determine that. I think in this case, under this peculiar set of facts, where the ammunition is actually found in an antique firearm, and there's lots of evidence about the antique firearm, that it's a popular gun, and so on and so forth. I think under that situation, the government does need to have that expert testimony about the design of the ammunition. I should have started off by mentioning I was going to focus on issue one. I want to mention briefly issue three, which is the sentencing issue on the divisibility of the statute. It's our position that the Supreme Court at this point has granted cert in the Discomps case. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that correctly. But it seems like the Supreme Court is getting ready to determine whether a statute needs to be divisible or not, in order for the Armed Career Criminal Act sentencing enhancement to apply. Obviously, it's our hope that you don't need to get to the sentencing issue, because you will find that Mr. Royal was entitled to a judgment of acquittal. However, if you think that sentencing issue does need to be addressed, I think probably the best thing to do is to wait until we have the Supreme Court's ruling in the Discomps case. I would just sum up by saying that, in the closing argument, the government said that this was a simple case and that the jury might be asking itself, why are we here? But the government then noted that every defendant has a right to have the government prove its case beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, it might be that this could have been a simple case if the government had put on proper expert testimony about the design of the bullets, but it didn't do that. And under the facts of this case, that means that the government didn't meet its burden, and Mr. Royal is entitled to a judgment of acquittal.
Okay, thank you, Mr. President.
Thank you.
You've got some time reserved. Let's hear from Mr. Sybil.
May it please the court. John W. Sybil, Jr., Assistant United States Attorney for the District of Maryland. Your Honors, you've asked some actually good questions this morning. That's actually some of your questions to defense counsel are issues that I wanted to focus on this morning. First off, as Your Honor, Judge Traxler noted, there's no requirement that the government present expert testimony in a simple gun or ammunition trial. The case law actually is supported. Unfortunately, we did not go into that detail in our briefing, but there is no requirement that you have expert testimony. Oftentimes, in a simple firearms possession case, there isn't an expert who sits there and says the gun meets the definition of a firearm as defined by federal law. We oftentimes do that, but oftentimes, to save time and not to waste the court's time, we'll have someone in a firearm unit. Most of our cases in Maryland come from Baltimore City, so someone from Baltimore City Police Department's firearms unit will on the trial and say that they were able to fire the firearm. And we would then argue that because the firearm could be fired, it therefore meets the definition of a firearm as defined by federal law. So I do not think that if we're required to have expert testimony in a firearms case, then likewise, we would not be required to have expert testimony in an ammunition case. Your Honor, the government did focus and have its expert, Special Agent Collier, focus on the antique firearm because as a trial lawyer, a jury is going to sit there and hear that in this case, you had a person who was non-compliant with police officers during a traffic stop, was combative with police officers during a traffic stop, was then searched and a firearm was found loaded with ammunition, but the firearm's not charged. The jury wants to hear why the firearm's not part of the case. So that's why we go into detail. But again, I think as Judge Diaz noted, and maybe it was Judge Traxler, that actually the Mixon case has a good phrase that says, it's not the location of the ammunition that's important. It's not. In this case, the jury saw the ammunition. As Judge Diaz noted, it was referred to as ammunition approximately 50 times. I went through the transcript and counted 50 times by both myself, my co-counsel, and defense counsel, either ammunition, cartridges, or bullets. At no point during the trial was there ever an issue raised about the design of the bullets, the ammunition. Never, no point. The officers were questioned about the ammunition that they recovered from the firearm. They testified that the bullets were recovered out of the firearm. And then our Interstate Nexus expert testified that it was ammunition manufactured by a specific manufacturer in three different states. And there's no other issue. The defense did not mention the design of the bullets, ammunition, in their opening statement. They didn't raise it with any witness. They didn't raise it during a Rule 29 motion. They did not request a specific jury instruction on it. They did not mention it in closing argument. The first time it was ever mentioned was in their appeal. And the government, as argued in the briefs, believes it is an affirmative defense. The government needed to be put on some notice that the design of the ammunition was an issue. And that's similar to a firearm case. If you're going to argue that the firearm is not a firearm, or it's a specific type of firearm, such as a long-barreled firearm or a short-barreled shotgun, the government has, those cases are slightly different because the government does have an obligation to specifically plead those types of firearms. But if you're going to challenge the design, the defense usually does it through a motion to dismiss, or they call their own expert, and that just simply wasn't done in this case. And I think it logically follows. The definition of firearm carves out an exception for antique firearms. And the case law is clear that that exception is an affirmative defense. I don't think there's any dispute that the antique firearm exception is an affirmative defense. And we don't practice that in our district, but some districts, prosecutors do charge antique firearms and leave it up to the defense to challenge whether or not is an antique firearm. Just our practice in our district is we just don't do it that way. If it's an antique firearm, we don't charge the firearm where we charge the ammunition. But because the antique firearm exception is an affirmative defense, it logically follows that within the definition of ammunition contains the word firearm. So if you get what I'm saying, if there's an antique firearm exception that's part of the definition of firearm, and firearm is part of the definition of ammunition, it logically flows that to challenge the design of ammunition as antique or for use, or you're arguing that the ammunition is solely for use in a non-antique firearm, that is an affirmative defense that would have to be raised at some point. And it just wasn't done in this case. It just was not done.
Well, the defense is that just the peculiar circumstances of this case, that the government conceded that it was dealing with an antique firearm and that the rounds themselves, that the ammunition was found in the chamber of the antique firearm, was by itself sufficient notice that you needed to prove a little bit more in this case.
Well, again, Your Honor, I focus on the quote in the Mixon case where the court in Mixon said, again, it's not the location of the firearm. You know, in this case, the jury heard that there were 32 caliber bullets. The jury saw the bullets. The bullets were published to the jury. They got to actually hold them if they wanted to, look at them. You know, this wasn't a case where we're dealing with musket balls or black powder type ammunition. These are bullets, just what you think are bullets. And a jury, again, a lot of times we like to believe that in a courtroom it's a vacuum where jurors rely on only what they hear in the courtroom, but we know that's not the case. Jurors bring their life experience. 32 caliber is actually a very common caliber. You can walk into a hunting store or a Dick's Sporting Goods store or a Walmart and purchase a 32 caliber weapon today. It's not something that is unique or rare. So like you pointed out, Judge Diaz, the expert witness sat on the stand and said bullets, where they were manufactured, and that they were ammunition, and the term ammunition was used throughout trial. I don't think that the fact that they were found in an antique firearm somehow raises the burden or is notice to the government that the defense is going to challenge that design, or that the government has then to take extra steps to prove that the ammunition was ammunition. I think then you're creating a burden that is above the elements that are called for in the statute, and then what's been similarly, it's analogous to the definition of a firearm. Again, we don't have to step, we can charge any firearm, but we don't have to step into court and prove that it wasn't an antique firearm. That's up to the defense to raise that either through a motion to dismiss or in a Rule 29 motion or through their own expert testimony. So again, analogizing it through that scenario, I don't think that the location of the bullets is material in the analysis of whether the government met its burden of proof in this case. So turning now to the, I think the important part, again, is just fairness. I think out of fairness, a lot of times the law doesn't necessarily act or react in a fair way, but in this case, fairness. The trial wasn't about, and was never about, the design of the ammunition in this case. You look through the transcript, again, there's no mention that the ammunition was anything but ammunition as defined under federal law, under Section 921 of Title 18. It was never mentioned in opening statements, during cross-examination, during Rule 29 motion, closing argument. It just wasn't mentioned. I think if you look at it just from a fairness point, the government met its burden of proof. It showed the jury bullets, ammunition. It was called ammunition by both sides. Both sides. They got to feel and touch the ammunition, and they were instructed properly by the district court. The defense never requested a specific instruction to somehow alert or cause concern, or that the jury should take another look at the ammunition to determine whether they were designed to be used in a firearm. It was just never mentioned until the appeal. And I just think that the government contends that pure fairness grounds, that how can that be? How can you not raise an argument, and particularly a unique argument like this, and expect the government would have to come forward and disprove what again, what we think is an affirmative defense. I think it's really the defense burden to come forward and say, we take issue, and that just didn't happen in this case. And I just briefly like to talk on the third issue, which is the sentencing issue. Since the Kirksey case was decided 14 years ago, this court has employed the modified categorical approach in its analysis of Maryland's second-degree assault convictions. And as recently as, I believe, of August of this year in the Gomez case, I know the defense alerted the court as the Gomez case. The Gomez case did not change that method of analysis of Maryland's second-degree assault convictions. I'm not sure what the Supreme Court's decision is going to do or how it's going to affect the outcome, but I know this court has applied and utilized the modified categorical approach in analyzing whether or not Maryland's second-degree assault convictions are is a violent felony for 14 years since the Kirksey case, either through published or unpublished decisions. And if the court has the transcript, upon careful review of that transcript, it was a crime of violence. The defendant punched and choked the victim in that case, so there's no doubt that that scenario of facts meets the definition of a violent felony or is a crime of violence. The defense also takes exception with the fact that they don't come out and call it an Alford plea, but I think they all but come out and say that the defendant took an Alford plea, but it wasn't an Alford plea. If you look carefully at the transcript, and this is directly in line with Judge Wilkinson's decision in the Taylor case, at no point, if you look at the transcript that's in or the plea colloquy that's included in the transcript, at no point did the defendant or his counsel in the state court proceedings ever indicate that it was an Alford plea. It just never happened. He stood before the court, indicated that he was going to plead guilty, that he wished to plead guilty. The prosecutor read the statement of facts through his attorney, never challenged those facts, never said, well, you know, we hear your facts, but we're not agreeing to those facts, nothing. Said, okay, I still want to plead guilty. And that is directly identical with the scenario in the Taylor case that Judge Wilkinson decided. So I don't think there's any issue with whether or not it was a whether that guilty plea was knowingly and voluntarily made. So with that, Your Honors, if you don't have any further questions for me.
Let me just make sure I understand your position on this third issue. Is
sure.
You would have us forge ahead, the scamps notwithstanding?
Yes, Your Honor. I think given the court's precedence, I think until there's some authority from the Supreme Court or that you continue utilizing the modified categorical approach, I have no idea what the Supreme Court's going to, how they're going to rule. And frankly, Your Honor,
You wouldn't be here.
Exactly. I'm really not too familiar with the issues that are raised. I know that it has to do with the visibility of statutes or something along those lines, but I'm not really familiar with the issues in the case. But again, for 14 years, the Fourth Circuit has been utilizing and applying the modified categorical approach in its analysis of Maryland's second-degree assault convictions, and I think that's the way the court should go, unless it's instructed otherwise in the future.
Okay.
So with that, thank you very much, Your Honor.
Mr. Frazier, you have some time reserved.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just a few points. Counsel mentioned that in the typical run-of-the-mill handgun case, there wouldn't need to be any expert testimony put on about the firearm and whether it had the characteristics that bring it under the definition of firearm under federal law. I think we can agree this is not a typical case because we had so much testimony about the fact that this gun did not meet the definition of firearm under federal law. I think in a non-typical, just a handgun case where the antique aspect is not at issue, but if there was something peculiar about the firearm, where there is a question raised about, perhaps because of its design, the way it looks, whether in fact it meets the definition of firearm because it is designed to expel a projectile through an explosion, you would need expert testimony in that case. So that's really what's going on here, is this is a peculiar set of facts where you do need to have some expert testimony to get across that line of establishing that the item does in fact meet the definition of a prohibited item. It is true that everybody referred to the bullets as ammunition throughout the trial. Government still has to meet its burden. If there's evidence in the record that a gun was an antique gun, but for some reason everybody missed it, if it came up on appeal, our position would be that the defendant's conviction should be reversed because Congress has not criminalized the possession of an antique firearm. Statements of counsel are not evidence. So I don't think that gets the government over the hump. Counsel mentioned that there was nothing about the bullets at trial. That's not entirely accurate. Defense counsel did ask the government's expert how old the bullets were, when they were manufactured. Defense counsel asked the government's expert, when were the bullets manufactured? The government's expert said, I don't know. That drew an objection. At sidebar, defense counsel said, well, perhaps they're antique ammunition. The judge shut that down, said, I'm not going to let you ask that. That's when the government's expert was still on the stand. And the government was able to do redirect after that. Could have, at that point, cleared up this issue about whether those bullets were designed to be used in a non-antique firearm. And finally, Mixon, which is the Seventh Circuit case, the court said in that case that the only issue in that case was, does the mere fact that bullets are in an antique firearm by definition take them out of the statute? And that's not what we're arguing. We're not arguing that any bullets found in an antique firearm become legal at that point. What we're arguing is that when you have the set of facts that we have in this situation, the government needs to provide some evidence that the bullets do in fact meet the definition required under the statute. I'm over my time.
Thank
you very much.
Okay, we'll come down and greet counsel.